to the podcast of the City Club of Eugene, Oregon. The City Club builds community vision through open inquiry and is dedicated to enabling an informed public on a wide range of topics. Coming up in today's program.
It is widely recognized that in many areas of social and economic life, some today are benefiting while others are not.
We appreciate the sponsors who make our civic work possible, including Kaiser Permanente, kp.org, Lane Community College, lanecc.edu, Peace Health, peacehealth.org, the University of Oregon, uoregon.edu, Lane County, and the City of Eugene. And here's today's program.
Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's December 13th, 2019 program, addressing asset poverty, from owing to owning. This is the 14th program of our 2019-2020 programming year. My name is Eric Richardson, and I serve as the president of the City Club of Eugene. Support for the City Club is provided by our members and sponsors. You can become a member of City Club at our website, cityclubofeugene.org. So now I'd like to bring up Joshua Purvis, who will tell us about today's program. Josh?
Thank you, Eric. According to new research by Oregon State University, a majority of Americans live in asset poverty, meaning they have few or no assets to rely on in the event of a financial crisis, such as a job loss or a medical emergency. Lacking assets like vehicles, homes, savings accounts, or investments, families are often unable to cope with crises without sacrificing basic needs like food, clothing, and shelter. Additionally, a growing body of research suggests that parents' asset levels also predict their children's educational expectations and academic achievement, including their likelihood of enrolling in and graduating from college. In a political environment that focuses more often on income inequality than on wealth inequality as a key determinant of economic well-being, are we, the American public, ignorant of the real underlying issue that prevents people from achieving the American dream? If policy prescriptions aimed at reducing poverty narrowly frame the issue in terms of income, do our elected leaders underutilize opportunities to ameliorate poverty through asset accumulation that could lead to greater self-sufficiency? Today, we'll hear from David Rothwell, who will define and discuss asset poverty as a key indicator for understanding economic vitality in the U.S. Dr. Rothwell is Associate Professor of Public Health and Human Sciences at Oregon State University. At OSU, he leads the Poverty and Inequality Group, which conducts research on poverty measurement and analysis of social policies that affect poverty. He earned a master's in social work from Tulane University and a PhD in social welfare from the University of Hawaii in Manoa. I'll now turn it over to Professor Rothwell to give his presentation. Professor Rothwell.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for the introduction, Joshua. Thank you, Eric. Thank you, the City Club of Eugene, for inviting me and importantly, choosing to talk about this topic of asset poverty today. The subject of asset poverty falls within a broader theme of social and economic inequality. And I want to frame the talk today around that theme as much about poverty and asset poverty. Before jumping into what I want to accomplish today, I want to acknowledge that any concern for poverty, whether that's assets, income, or otherwise, is part of this broader concern for inequality of both opportunity and inequality in outcomes. It is widely recognized that in many areas of social and economic life, some today are benefiting while others are not. And it's incumbent upon us who care about civic engagement to be informed of what's going on. Debates about whether or not these patterns are just or good for society are inherently political. They are ongoing, and to get into all of this is well beyond the top the ability. I can't accomplish all of this in this short talk, but I will focus on three things. Why assets matter? What are some of the theoretical and conceptual background for why wealth and assets matter? I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the empirical research, the science behind it. And then towards the end, I'm going to frame some discussion around what I think is going on in Oregon. You know, at the end, I hope you'll have a better understanding for why wealth and assets matter and what we need to do about asset poverty. I believe that to develop good policy and interventions, we need to establish some basic facts about the problem and of concern to understand how we can address them. So the distribution of wealth and assets is a huge topic, and I'm going to really focus on the bottom 50% of the wealth distribution. I'm going to mostly focus my interest on families, children and families, and I'm going to present some descriptive research. As I said, I'm not going to prescribe policies to address these problems. And there's a lot of limitations in what I'll present, and one of them is that we don't fully consider all of the causes of asset poverty, or there's major things that are missing. So with that, I'll go ahead and get started here. So within the topic of economic inequality, most of the discussion on that topic is about incomes. When you read the newspaper, the magazine headlines like the one shown on the screen from the Atlantic Monthly, talking about the new American aristocracy, These are mostly about incomes. So there's a real minority of focus on wealth and assets. I did a Google search, and just to find out the difference between who searches for income and income inequality and wealth inequality. And as I would expect, the income inequality searches into Google were about three times more frequent than assets or wealth. So there's most of the research is on income inequality. A small amount is on wealth. And of that amount that's on wealth, most of that focuses on the upper end of the distribution, on high wealth individuals. Recent books about how high wealth people hide their wealth and tax evasion and growing wealth of CEOs in the country, that's where most of the press and where a lot of the data has come. My research and my interest is instead on the lower part of the distribution and focusing on what low-income people in the middle and lower classes and their wealth and financial well-being. So that's where I'm going to focus on. To start out, it's important to define the terms of engagement here. What do we mean by assets? Technically, when economists or social sciences think about assets, it means income that is not consumed. You know, there's two major type of resources that we're talking about for family finances, income and assets. And so when we don't consume that income, it turns into an asset. On assets, there are total assets, which are financial assets and non-financial assets, and net worth is total assets minus debts. All of these are important. Most of the work I'll be talking about, and I'll hone in the focus on financial assets. And we'll hear later from the folks from Mercy Corps on homes and home ownership and some of the other, I think, more non-financial assets. But we're really talking about liquid forms of wealth and assets. So if you think about your own balance sheets and your own family finances, we're talking about things like checking, savings, things you can access and you can have liquid access to. You can get access to this cash quite quickly. This non-consumed income is important for social welfare, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. So people talk about assets as having a number of qualities that income does not. And I'm really just brushing the surface here. You can read entire volumes on each one of these points, but really, people think about income as flows of resources coming in and out, whereas assets are more long-term permanent. People think of them as stocks rather than flows. They're more permanent. Assets have a long-term accumulation. We don't, you know, especially if you think about how wealth is passed on from generation to generation through inheritance and other mechanisms, wealth is much more long-term than income. Compared to income, wealth and assets are invested. We can generate more wealth and more assets from those that exist. And the last point there is that income and wealth are correlated. You might be thinking, you know, most people that have high wealth also have high assets, but the correlation is not as high as many people think. So these are important kind of functions that assets have that we must keep in mind. As an academic, I have to put some theory and some academic theory on here. There's kind of three schools of thought for why assets are important for social welfare. The first one is one that is probably the most common and comes to mind, is that assets serve as an insurance mechanism to smooth shocks of consumption. That's what economists talk about. So when you have an unexpected event in your life, you draw down your assets or your savings to get by. That's a very important mechanism, but it's not the only one. The other things that are important, and there's others that aren't here, but these are, in my view, the most important, is stratification. So wealth and assets function to divide society into groups that have power and other groups that have less power. And we see these divisions in society. And if we think about assets and wealth as an indicator of this stratification, it gives us insight into social and economic inequality. The last one is that the theory and the idea goes that asset holding will promote individual and social development in ways that income cannot. And so the easiest way to think about it is, if you have assets, if you're owning wealth, you may think about the future in a way different than if you had very low assets and low wealth. You're thinking about how to do things for yourself, your family, your community in ways that are different from income. Okay, consumption, stratification, and development. I could go on for a long time on this too, but there is a growing amount of evidence that has empirically found a distinct relationship between assets and a variety of outcomes that is different from income. You know, these are some of the things. The most important idea is that assets promote a sense of financial security and this sense of long-term well-being. Okay, for example, I mentioned assets have been shown to change the way people think about the future. Assets also help families locate into healthy and safe environments. They help people be more selective in the labor market, and so on. We've done some research showing that when people have assets and they use them for that consumption method to smooth unexpected events and reduce family stress. All of these have downstream effects on family well-being. Okay, so that's the first part. Now I'm going to talk to you a little bit about how we measure asset poverty and what we know about asset poverty in our country. So the famous management strategist Peter Drucker said, if you can't measure it, you can't improve it. I think many people are interested in reducing economic inequality, reducing asset poverty, and so therefore we need to measure it. The Nobel laureate economist Angus Deaton talked about how measurement, even without an understanding of the mechanisms, can be of great importance in and of itself. Policy change is frequently based on it. So there are good reasons to focus on measurement. Here's our paper. The idea is that if we operate under the assumption that assets matter, as I just told you previously, that assets are different from income, it begs the question, at what level are assets low? Or what level are they high? At what level might they affect people? And then, of course, once we draw that level, then we want to know how big of a problem is this and how many people are affected by it. So when we talk about asset poverty, we just go back to thinking about poverty measurement in general. And any poverty measure has three components. We have resources, we have some threshold, and we have the time, which is usually a year. So there's a lot of ink spilled and arguments had over how to count these resources and how to define the thresholds. I'll start with some examples. So the U.S. poverty line that you read about in the newspaper, as an informed citizenry, you would see every September that the poverty rate in the country or in the state of Oregon has gone up or down based on the U.S. official poverty measure. And this measure, for those three components, it includes pre-tax cash income. The threshold of need is defined as, it was based in 1963, and it was defined as the cost of food times three, and that was the poverty line. So if you can think about, well, there's a lot to say about that threshold, but if you can think about what an average family spends on food and then times that by three, that was the basis of the poverty line. Well, the price of food and how families spend their money has changed a lot since 1963, but we still use this threshold today to define poverty. So for a family of two adults and one child, a family of three, take those resources and you divide them by the threshold and you get a ratio that determines whether you're poor or not. So in an example family that has $15,000 of household income, the poverty threshold was $17,000. The $15,000 is below the $17,000 and therefore they're poor. That's how it works. And then we count how many families, how many individuals, how many children in a given location fall below that threshold, okay? That's how it works. Well, it turns out we can extend the same logic, the same framework for measuring poverty to think about asset poverty. We just exchange instead of counting income in the resources, we count the assets. And then we take the threshold of the income poverty line and we say, well, it's reasonable to assume that you could be able to survive at the poverty line for 3 months if you lost your job. This can be debated. This is not the only way to do it. But if you take the poverty line and divide it into a three-month interval, then we think that is the most standard asset poverty threshold. So what does that mean for measurement? You can think of the family size-adjusted threshold around $5,000, goes up or down depending on the family size. But when we do all of those adjustments with the data, this is how we count asset poverty. So for example, a family that only has $3,000 of liquid assets, they would be below the $5,000 threshold. And so therefore that family would be counted as asset poor. Then we take the best household survey data available and kind of count how many people fall above or below the threshold. I hope that makes sense. It's kind of simplifying some things, but those are the technical details of it. So we've done some work asking this question of asset poverty, mostly among children across countries. And some of our findings show that the U.S. has a pretty high rate of child asset poverty. In fact, 2 out of 3 children in the U.S. fall below this threshold of asset poverty. 2 out of 3. That's a lot. When we look at other countries, such as, Italy is around 45%, and then in a place like Norway, it's 1 in 3 children are living in a household with low assets. So we see really wide cross-national variation on this. Also important to point out that asset poverty is 2 to 3 times higher than income poverty. We know they're correlated, but they're not the same thing. And our research shows that when we compare countries and we control statistically for family structure, education, labor market attachment, things like this, we still find that children in the U.S. have a higher risk of being born into or being raised in a family who is asset poor than all the countries with available data. This is fascinating in itself, and trying to understand. We have a whole program of research trying to understand these patterns. Now, you may be wondering what causes asset poverty. Who are those that are more likely to be asset poor? I'm sure you have some ideas in your head of who these types of families might be. All the usual suspects are there. Single parent families have really high asset poverty, like 82%. But this alone doesn't explain this cross-national difference. things like family structure, education, age, and employment status are all related, but the most important thing that distinguishes the U.S. compared to other countries is how education matters. So if you have low education, your risk for asset poverty in the U.S. is much higher than a similarly low-educated person in another country. So this gives us an insight into what's going on in the U.S. and our society to cause this relationship. We don't have the answer, but we're working on it. Okay, so that's a little tidbit on the science of asset poverty. Now I want to talk about, shift our focus here back home to Oregon. There is research on asset poverty for many of the states. On this, the most similar indicator that we have, you would see here that Oregon falls kind of in the upper 25% of states. They have one of the lower asset poverty rates, Oregon does. You see the national rate is around 44%, 45% of all people. The work I was showing was children. So this is all people, liquid asset poverty. The group that does this work, Prosperity Now, is doing excellent work to talk about wealth and assets and make policy recommendations. But as a research scientist, I want to just caution these data. They come from pretty small sample sizes with large margins of error, and it's kind of difficult to say with certainty that this is the exact asset poverty level. It's helpful, but I think there's a lot more to be said about the numbers. So that's where I start. And then I think this is one of my last things I want to talk about are what Thomas Piketty, who wrote a really really fascinating book on the history of capital, talk about a big subject. And he talked about it. He talked about worrisome forces of divergence and convergence. The story of inequality and asset poverty is not one that's all negative or certainly not all positive, but we need to think about the social forces that are working here. So I thought about what's going on in Oregon and talked about divergence and convergence here. So in Oregon, we know that the growth in the economy is happening a lot for low wage and unstable jobs. We also know that we have high childcare costs in the state that place a considerable economic burden on our families. And we have inequalities that are rooted very early in the education system that we need to address. Okay, so those are the worrying trends of divergence. On convergence, on things that might be reducing inequality, we have to recognize that we've seen a decade of strong economic growth in the state that is lifting many families' living standards. We've seen progressive policies on minimum wages, investments in early childhood and education this past session, and important policies that put Oregon on the map, things like the Oregon Saves program, state earned income tax credit, and the recently passed parental leave policy. So to close, I just want to reiterate four points that you might have picked up on along my talk. But the first one is that there are theoretical and important reasons to measure assets and asset poverty in addition to income. And these are not just a consumption story. It's not just about getting through the unexpected expense, but there's good evidence to suggest that wealth affects family well-being in other ways. The second point is that when we do measure asset poverty, it's the level of asset poverty is high. It's, the first time I saw the numbers and thinking about 2 out of 3 children living in a family with low assets, that struck me as high. Many families are on the financial edge, so to speak. The third point is that children are at a unique risk for asset poverty, and children growing up today in these conditions are going to, this has implications for the future. We're studying inequality today, but for the children that are growing up in these conditions, I have concerns about where this is going to lead our society in the future. And last, as a good academic, I have to acknowledge the limitations here. We're kind of in the early stages of this topic. People have only been studying asset poverty for 15 years or so, and so we need a lot better theories to understand what explains these. A lot of the problem has been a limited data access, and so there's really only so much we can do, but there we have it. I want to thank you for your time today and look forward to the rest of the program.
I'd like to turn today's program over to Josh, our program coordinator, who will take it from here. Josh.
Thank you, Eric. Josh Purvis, City Club member and program coordinator. This question is for John and Sven of Mercy Corps. The question is, how is Mercy Corps' Community Investment Trust a response to asset poverty in the Pacific Northwest, and how has it been designed for replication by other organizations and other communities?
Okay, I'm John Haynes with Mercy Corps, the Community Investment Trust in Portland. First of all, it's great to be in Eugene. This is where I started my career as a banker, as a management trainee 30 years ago, right down the street at what was then First Interstate, now Wells. It's good to see First Interstate back in town. A franchise bank out of Montana moved into the state with the purchase of Bank of the Cascades. Anyway, the Community Investment Trust, Sven and I are going to tag team a quick presentation on what it is. So we're going to talk about the people. It starts with the people. It ends with the people. We're going to talk about the product, the purpose, and the prospects and our goal of reaching 1 million people nationwide in 5 years. The Community Investment Trust is a financial product aimed at the poor. We started by calling it renter equity, so giving an affirmative upward path for renters to gain access to an investment path they otherwise are excluded from. And we changed the name to Community Investment Trust really to capture a wider motivation of all people in a neighborhood. But our target is first-time investors, low-income people that otherwise don't have access to an investment path. It's an investment in a commercial real estate building. We'll talk about the building when Sven jumps on. Here's the five differences. It's the first one in the nation. It's in Portland, out in East Portland, 122nd Market. And the investment product is for people to be able to buy the building. It's not them purchasing the building. We purchased the building, and we shifted it into a corporation, and they buy it as shareholders over the course of time at $10, $25, $50, or $100 a month, fitting into people's budget. It's downside risk protected through a letter of credit with a bank, so investors can get their money out anytime they want with a guaranteed no loss provision. We offer a class called Moving from Owing to Owning and Budgeting, Goal Setting, the risk and return of a range of investments, and then we present this at the end. Sven, you want to jump in on the property?
Sven Gatchi of Mercy Corps and Community Investment Trust. To tell you a little bit about the property, about the place. So as we mentioned, this is East Portland. East Portland is the area of town where about 30% of the people live, but actually 60% of the youth, the children in the city live. And it's also the census tract is some of the most racially and culturally diverse in the state of Oregon. We're in the school next door to us. There's over 40 languages spoken as a first language at home. The property, it's a commercial property, about 27 for-profit and non-profit tenants rent from it. It's a naturally occurring, affordable space that really a great variety of tenants rent there. So we have a Somali-owned taxi cab company, a Latina-owned hair salon, a number of nonprofits from Ethiopian Eritrean Community Center to the Somali Association of Oregon to tax preparers in four or five different languages from to affordable a Russian-owned hair salon, for instance. So that's the property, and the community owns it. And from place, this is place to people, and who are the people that currently own the property? So as we mentioned, we transferred ownership to the community about 2 years ago, 26 months ago, actually, to be exact. And we currently have about 150 investors. There's room for about 400 investors to buy out all the available equity in the property over the next 3 to 4 years. Who are the people that currently are investing, those 150 investors? They've all gone through the classes. We've taught it in 9 different languages. We have about 70% of the people have never invested before. About 60% are renters. Nearly 60% of community of color. About 60% are from households that make under $40,000 a year. So we're already seeing that the people are exactly the people that we're hoping to see.
Let me talk about prospects for us. We needed to do a proof of concept. This was the first time anybody had done anything like this in the nation. We incubated this about 8 years ago. We felt the motivation of the people. We started with a human-centered design, talked with people in affordable housing out in East Portland, and they told us what's missing in the neighborhood, what challenges they felt were coming. Portland's gentrified. A lot of the nation is gentrified. They're feeling pressures of that. And they were missing some of the services that they wanted. So we got a list of what was missing, what they felt were challenges, and then asked people if they saved or invested. Nobody, none of the renters invested, and a handful of them saved, but on a periodic basis. So one fact to add is that 100 million Americans don't have $400 in the bank. And the wealth divide, this is why we did this, the wealth divide, the top 1% owns 77% of assets, the bottom 50%. Own 1%. So that wealth gap is persistent, it's growing, and it's more evident in communities of color and people that don't have upward mobility paths through family wealth, education access, et cetera. The prospects now that we've got a proof of concept, we've been speaking around the country, we've got national advisors, and we want to work in 55 cities in 5 years and touch 1 million families. And right now we've got interest around Oregon. We hope to talk with some people this afternoon in Eugene about doing this. Other places in Oregon are really interested. Outside of that, they're falling nationally into three or four pockets. One are tough urban cities that have wide swaths of poverty. That includes Milwaukee, Wisconsin, St. Louis, Missouri. Other ones have built upon deep long-term planning processes, and they find the opportunity for an investment product for the poor, for lower-income people. By the way, our investment product is open to everybody. We don't income require it. If you want to be involved, you take the class, you pass an understanding test, and you're in. Senator Merkley lives five blocks away, and he's very interested in this, but we've said you have to take the class first. It's one of the requirements. The other pocket, then, as I mentioned, is people building off planning efforts. We've done a feasibility study, and a likely second project is going to be in Colorado Springs. They want to engage youth, and the superintendent of schools said, I want middle and high school students to be investors in a building. Now, Colorado Springs is an interesting example because they are excited about an Amazon distribution center coming in at their municipal airport at $15 an hour jobs. At the same time, the strip malls all around town are in the state of repair that you see nationally. You know, people are buying online and those strip malls are going downhill. So we're trying to converge a strategy to re-tenant the building to meet the needs of youth and the motivation of youth with some other attributes. So those are planning process. That's Fresno, California, Colorado Springs, a couple others. The other is First Nation, Native American populations in the Navajo Nation, and then off reservation in Phoenix, Arizona. There's a group of the wide diaspora of people from various nations in one neighborhood. It's about 125 to 150,000 people. An organization's been there for 48 years, and they want to institute a community investment trust in a property that looks very similar to ours in Portland, a 1962 mid-century strip mall.
If you enjoyed this presentation by the City Club of Eugene, please visit our website at cityclubofeugene.org or our Facebook page for more topics. We hope you are inspired to join us for our next podcast episode.